Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first part of the show today, we will be spending some time talking about the health of the Great Lakes. And certainly that there are many environmental scientists who are concerned that the Great Lakes are showing signs of some extreme stress. And it comes from a variety of directions. There certainly is a problem with pollutants, toxic things in the water. There is a continuing problem, and has been for some time, with introduced species. There are problems that come with changes in land use on the shoreline and the areas around the lakes. And there are problems that aren't particularly new and have been growing over some time. And for that reason, some scientists and some others say, well, yes, certainly we have a problem here, but it's taken some time for the problem to develop, and so that means maybe we have some time to work on the solution. And others would say, no, that's not right. We do have a problem now. And if we don't do something about it now, things will continue to get worse. And there might come a point where they are not fixable, not repairable. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about the present health and the future of the Great Lakes with William Sullivan. He is associate professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. And he's particularly, among other things, is particularly interested in the interaction between people and the environment and how people's experiences with nature affect their functioning as people. He also is involved with something called the Illinois Indiana Sea Grant, which is a program. The Sea Grant College program has one here for Illinois and Indiana is one of a number of them. They're created by Congress back in the mid-60s, federally funded, and they bring together people in universities and in government and in business, all of them concerned with understanding and addressing the needs of the Great Lakes. Questions and comments are certainly welcome here on this program. 333-9455 is our number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you might hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that. It's 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's nice to be here.
Let me ask you just this basic question to start. And again, as I have read about this, there are people who apparently the people who say, yes, indeed, we have a problem. We recognize that there's some serious issues with Great Lakes health. And related to those things that I mentioned, we do have this problem with introduced species, and we do have problems with pollution in water quality, and we do have problems with runoff from the land around the lakes. But then they say something like, well, you know, those aren't new problems. That's been going on for some time now, and things it's taken some while for the conditions to get to the point where they are now. So then they would say, that means that we're not going to say that we don't have a problem, we shouldn't do anything. But they're going to say something like, well, you know, it took some time for this problem to develop, and we have some time to deal with it. Let's talk about that. Just how bad is it? How bad are conditions in the lakes? And should we approach this with some urgency?
That's a very important question, and I think there is a perspective that these problems have been building up over time, and I think there was some sense that in the 60s and 70s we reached a very threatening point in terms of the health of the ecosystems of the Great Lakes, and we took some corrective actions, and generally the health improved. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense that, oh, you know, we can back off from these difficult conditions. There's also a sense that the lakes have a sense or have a capacity to be resilient. And I think the basic question that we're focusing on here today is to what extent have we pushed that capacity to be resilient to the tipping point? Mm-hmm. And the fear is that there are so many stressors at such intense levels right now that we're to the point where if we're not careful, we may get to the point where we change the ecosystems associated with the Great Lakes beyond the point at which we can repair them, and that they'll change very dramatically from here. In talking about the health of the lakes and the different approach that we're taking now and that we're advocating that should be taken now, it's important to think about the lessons that we've had from ecology. One of the most important lessons that we know from ecology is the interrelatedness of nature. We used to think, or many people used to think, of nature and the components as being kind of discrete parts. And we've learned that nothing could be further from the truth, that really nature is an integrated whole. And we've also learned that if you make a change in one aspect, one natural element, that over time you're likely to find that that has an impact, an unintended consequence in another area, an area that you may not have predicted in the long run. And that's a very important lesson that we've learned and that we're trying to apply to the question of the health of the Great Lakes today.
Mm-hmm. Well, there, that seems to me to be a really significant point that people need to understand when you look at these individual problems that we've talked about. Pollution, say, from cities going to the water. So you have sewage getting into the water, or you have agricultural runoff, so you have fertilizer getting in the water, or you have a soil that gets washed off and gets into the water, or you have the problem of the introduced species who are coming in, and all of these things individually are significant problems, but there's a lot of overlap, and there's a way in which all of these things tend to mount up, perhaps make associated problems worse. And that it is indeed the combination of all of this, all of these things all going on at the same time, potentially increasing the seriousness of each other, that makes it somehow you get a problem that's maybe almost a little bit more than the sum of the parts.
I think that's exactly right, and that's what we're concerned about. When you think about the set of problems that we're facing, invasive species, non-point source pollution, the change in the shoreline in terms of urban development, the reduction of wetlands, the change of how water is introduced into the Great Lakes through the tributaries, the air pollution that deposits heavy metals like mercury into the water, and the whole question of water withdrawals from the lake. There's a set of stressors there that together are creating what we consider to be a very dangerous set of conditions that need immediate and urgent attention. And that, you know, we haven't even mentioned in that set of stressors the potential of global warming, which the global warming models have profound implications for the Great Lakes. The majority of the models suggest that there's going to be a significant decline in lake water levels, and a decline in lake water levels will have very important social and economic and ecological impacts.
So that's sort of a looming background issue that all this other stuff gets piled on top of, where you say it's bound to have some effect. Perhaps we're not exactly sure what, but it can't be good.
Well, I'm aware of 10 different models that have been run that look at changes in global temperature and the impacts on the lakes. One of the 10 suggests that over the next century there'll be increase in global temperature here, and that will relate to increased water temperature, which will relate to increased evaporation. And one of those models says that we'll have a lake level rise of maybe a foot, and the other 9 models in that set of 10 predict decreases from 12 inches to 5 feet. And a 5-foot decrease in lake level will have just enormous impacts on how we use the lakes, on how we generate electricity and cool our hydroelectric plants, how we transport goods and materials in the water. It'll even have really profound impacts on the salinity of the Eastern Basin, because at that low level, water may start coming in from the Atlantic Ocean and change the whole ecological nature of the Eastern Basin.
Let's talk specifically about some of these things. And I'm interested, for example, on the sort of the pollution issue, and that there are apparently 2 things that are going on. There are both continuing problems with point sources and with non-point, meaning that with a point source, that's that thing where you can go to the source and you can point at it and say, here it is. So that would be something like a city, for example, that ended up putting sewage or other kinds of municipal waste into the water. And then the non-point would be more general kind of, say, runoff from farm fields where you would get the fertilizer that's sprayed on the field getting washed off by the rain and into the water. How are those, what's happening with those two things?
Well, the contaminants are a really important issue, and there's historical components as well. So there, we've got, like you say, we've got point solution where we know it's happening, and one of the biggest factors there is raw sewage that gets into the lakes. Now, it sounds surprising that this in this day and age we still have raw sewage getting into the Great Lakes. It's outrageous, isn't it?
That would be my immediate sort of reaction. Yes.
But in fact, it happens frequently. Billions of gallons of raw sewage enter the Great Lakes every single year. And the reason for that is that we have so many of the older cities that surround the Great Lakes have combined sewage systems. When I say combined systems, I mean systems in which the stormwater, the rainwater that falls, goes into the same set of pipes that households and businesses and industries that have wastewater from home use, toilets and bathtubs, all that water gets collected in the same area. It's shunted off to a treatment plant that has a certain capacity that it can handle on a daily basis. And that water is then cleaned and treated and then deposited back into the Great Lakes. Now, what happens is occasionally you'll get a major storm. And that storm will put, if you have an inch or inch and a half of rain at one period of time, that storm will overwhelm the capacity of the treatment plant to treat that water. And what happens then is they flip a switch and they shunt the water, that rainwater and sewage that's mixed together, right into the lakes. And that happens to the tune of billions of gallons per year.
It strikes me here as one of these problems. And any of these things, if we talk about, well, how do we address them? It sounds like it's a problem in the sense that there are many different people that have to all be on the same page to agree this is a problem and we're going to find a solution. And of course, at the end of the day, it's going to mean spending money.
Right.
Say with a problem like that, you know, if you have some municipality, they've already got a lot of money invested in their infrastructure, and you're going to come along and say to them, well, probably the solution to this problem is going to involve spending money to develop some kind of new system or improve the system that you have. And they say, well, we only have so much money and we have so many problems. We have some other things that we want to concentrate on. And how does one, at the very least, get all the municipalities together and say, we recognize this is the problem and we're going to do something about it?
Well, that's a good question. I think one of the first step is to recognize that the Great Lakes are a national and an international treasure. The Great Lakes hold 20% of the fresh water on the earth, and they provide drinking water for about 35 million people. And I don't know how many municipalities and local governments take their drinking water or their water for their industrial purposes from the lake. But I do know that just in the Chicago metropolitan region alone, the Northeastern Illinois Planning Commission serves 272 local units of government. And that's just in the northeastern portion of Illinois. So you can imagine there are probably many thousands of governmental actors that impact and have some jurisdiction over the Great Lakes. As soon as you've got that level of complexity, you realize that it has to be dealt with between the states and the federal government. Mm-hmm. And actually, I would argue that the federal government is the only entity that really has the capacity to and the muscle to provide the kinds of resources that are necessary to make sure that we protect the Great Lakes in the long run. And in fact, it's quite exciting to know that there are three bills in Congress right now, two in the House and one in the Senate, that provide significant money, that would provide significant money for Great Lakes restoration from the low end of a little less than $4 billion to up to $8 billion. With $8 billion, you could really begin to address some of these infrastructure issues.
Although I think that I'm now trying to think of what sort of figures that I have read when people are talking about the extent of the problem and how much it would cost to fix it. Aren't we talking about hundreds of billions of dollars?
Well, I think
ultimately
the Great Lakes Sea Grant directors, we've discussed how $20 billion would go an awful
long way. Maybe it's 20 I'm thinking of and not 200 then. Uh-huh. But we're talking about a significant amount of money and probably a kind of expense that the states, if you're just saying, well, this should be something that the states that surround the lakes should be footing the bill for, you would say that it was something that the states couldn't do by themselves.
Certainly the state of Illinois couldn't come up with even $1 billion for this. It's beyond the capacity of a state to address these problems.
How well are the states doing? Because certainly we know that the states, the state governments of the states that border on the lakes are concerned about it. You hear them talking about it. How effective have the states been in coming together and first of all saying this is an important resource for all of us. We need to protect it, and we all need to be working together to protect it. And then going beyond simply saying that to doing something.
Well, the states have been moderately effective at doing that. I would say that Mayor Daley's been one of the champions. He's been one of the leaders of government who've pulled together other mayors and have raised this up the flagpole and made this a major issue. And I think he, through his pulpit and his energy and commitment towards these issues, he's been able to raise this up and help support the U.S. Legacy Act, which is a federal program that is supposed to allocate or has set $270 million of restoration money aside. I don't know if it's been set aside. They've earmarked $270 million for this. $35 million have been allocated so far. And the idea is that we'll use that money to clean up 43 hot spots or contaminated areas along the lake or along the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And with respect to Lake Michigan, we're talking about the Milwaukee Estuary and Waukegan Harbor, the Grand Calumet River, the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, the Rudiman Creek, which is an incredibly toxic area that the creek empties into a pond that then drains into Lake Michigan. It's one of the most toxic spots in the country because of industrial activities that occurred along the creek. Since the 1930s. It's full of PCBs and heavy metals, and it's been posted as no swimming for many decades now. And that's in the process of being cleaned up.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, William Sullivan. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He's also Interim Director of Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant, which is one of a number of college programs there across the country. This program was created by the Congress back in the mid-60s, and it brings together resources of universities and government and business who are concerned about and looking for ways to address the needs of the Great Lakes. And we're talking here this morning about the present health of the Great Lakes and their future. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just going back to the issue we were talking about before, if you're talking about pollution of the water, both say we're talking about municipal runoff and problems of sewage from cities. We're also talking about things that come from industry. So there needs to be two sort of things going on here. Not only do you have to stop that going into the water in the first place, there are particularly places where you actually have to go and clean the water. Do both of those things?
All right, I think so. So there's a question of the sediments. And I think there's some debate right now about, you know, what sediments do you leave and not disturb? Because as soon as you start to clean up, that you run the risk of placing those toxic chemicals into the water column. You need to take very careful measures to make sure that that doesn't happen. And there's both actual work going on and research associated with that actual work to see how we can improve those processes.
Yeah. So I guess part of my question is wondering about to what extent that if you can stop introducing new pollutants in over time, the lake will clean itself, will take care of itself? Or do you have to say, well, that's some of that will happen, but there are certain things that are so persistent in the environment that we don't want there that we actually have to go and physically try to remove those things?
Yeah,
as well.
There's definitely that. That we will definitely need to go in certain areas and clean up the sediments. I think just as importantly, or perhaps more importantly, we need to go in and make sure that the water coming into the lakes is we need to restore the shoreline as much as possible to create a healthier set of wetland conditions, because mm-hmm. the wetlands have a tremendous capacity to filter pollutants and create an ecosystem that's much richer and healthier. And the natural condition along the lakes used to be one of considerable wetlands, and the water used to flow slowly through those wetlands. And the materials that we're now introducing into our farmlands or that are runoff from our city streets because of all kinds of chemicals that are associated with running automobiles, that pretty much bypasses any of those natural systems right now and gets shunted right into the water column. Mm-hmm. And so one of the most important things that we can do is we can restore the ecosystem's self-regulating mechanisms along the shoreline. That's really a critical step.
And it sounds like it's the same. We're starting to maybe to focus on this problem to some extent when it talks about the coastal waters of the United States, those that border on the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. And we have come to understand there's some significant environmental impacts of coastal development. We now know more and more people have moved and have built on the coast, and you can understand why people like to live near the water, except for the fact that these are sometimes fragile ecosystems. And by doing what we have done, we have disturbed the way, the natural way that things work in some of those same ways. And it sounds like you're saying that we've done the very same thing around the lakes as well, because people like the idea of living on the lake and that there has been a lot of development. And I would imagine there are probably more people living close to the lake now than there ever have been in the past.
Not only that, but the NPSC, the Northeastern Illinois Planning Commission, predicts that there will be another 2 million people entering the Chicago metropolitan region by 2025. So in the next 20 years, we're expecting 2 million more people. And that's a very sobering number, because, as you know, we're taking the amount of water out of Lake Michigan at its legal limit at the moment. And that, you know, so we're going to need to figure out how we provide drinking water for 2 million additional people. Also, the strain on the environment, the stress on the environment that an additional 2 million people will provide could be considerable.
Yeah, not only are they drinking more water, they're producing more waste.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We have a couple of callers here to talk with. Let's do that, starting with someone in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if we have any, you know, experience with other large freshwater lakes. You know, certainly aren't as large as, you know, the Great Lakes together. I wonder if there's other places that have gone through this situation before, and, you know, just what are the outlooks for getting it cleaned up? You talked about if you could stop some of the input that the lake reconstitute itself. I was wondering if you could go into that in a little more detail. And I guess parallel with the warming of the earth, a large number of people outside the United States, at least, are you know, basically saying that things are going to have to be done very quickly in the next decade, or the increase will become something that we can't do anything about no matter what we do, except maybe chip away at it a tad. But, you know, the snowball is so big, nobody's going to stop it. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Well, go ahead. I'm not an atmospheric scientist, and but I do try to keep touch on the summary work, pieces of work that summarize the questions of global warming. And I think there's two things to understand. First of all is that the Earth has a long history of going through periods of global heating and cooling that are associated with the oscillation of the Earth's rotation, the sunspots, changes in our solar condition, changes in current patterns within the oceans. So there's a long history of global warming and cooling. The question now is, to what extent are the patterns that we're seeing associated with human behavior, especially the amount of carbon that we've been putting into the atmosphere? And it looks, my reading of the literature suggests that the amount of carbon that we're putting in has looks like it's having an impact, and the trajectory, the line of that you, if you projected out, suggests that we're going to have very serious questions about global warming that we're going to need to face very soon. And we may be getting to the point where we're already putting so much carbon in the atmosphere that we're getting to the point where this may be accelerating. So I think we need to, if I was the, let's see, I'm not even sure the president can do this, but, you know, I would suggest that we need to deal with this in very substantial ways. This is one of the most important public policy questions that I think governments, states, and the federal government face today. And I think we need hundreds of examples of how we might address this. We need all kinds of experiments and possibilities that help us see how we're going to live with less reliance on fossil fuels and how we're going to put fewer and fewer concentrations or tons of carbon into the atmosphere on a daily basis.
Okay, well, let's talk with someone else. The next caller is in Chicago, line one.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I'd provide some information which you might find interesting and useful, particularly for the ordinary consumer. I'm putting it in human terms. When I came to Chicago to go to college, it was down on the south side. This was 55 years ago, and one of the guys in the dormitory who was from Hawaii had done a good bit of fishing in Hawaii, was dirt poor, and he would go down to the lake, Lake Michigan, about a half mile to a mile away, once or twice a week, and go fishing and bring back enough to live on for several days. Now, when I moved north to Rogers Park here, which is about a half mile from Evanston, I would go down on Saturdays and Sundays, and there was a pier built by the WPA back in the 30s on which people would come to fish off of on Saturdays and Sundays, and the thing was lined with hundreds of people fishing, and of course they were catching fish like crazy. Now when you go down there, no fish, nobody going fishing there except for two or three souls a day or something like that, and when they do catch fish, well, you, on occasion you see some salmon or some trout washed up on the shore, and their sides are eaten out, and basically from the pollution in the lake. And essentially, this is the state of the lakes these days. I think that's about all I wanted to mention, except I could describe the situation in the New York metropolitan area, Newark Bay and New York Bay and the Hudson River, which is very similar, although mm-hmm. New York, the Hudson River is being cleaned up and things are improving.
Well, I appreciate the story and the comment. I think that sort of is one illustration of the kind of thing that we have talked about. And certainly there has been a concern about the impact on fish in the lake from both overfishing and from pollution and from introduced species. And certainly one of the things that also people have been cautioned about is eating the fish that come out of the lake.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think there's a host of issues that we could talk about, right, with respect to this call. And let's touch on a couple of them quickly here.
Yeah, sure.
The first is there have been, I guess, one of the examples of ecosystem breakdown that we're seeing is the large-scale disappearance of white fish and other large fish that would attract people who are anglers who would like to fish. They're just disappearing. And there's two reasons for that. One is overfishing. And the second reason is the contaminants in the water. But a third and very important reason is that there have been really important changes to the ecosystem because of these invasive species, species that human beings have introduced from other areas in the earth now that have taken hold in the Great Lakes. Aquatic invasive species have produced changes in the available nutrients that support the zooplankton and other kind of the lowest level on the food web. And there's recent information that, we're not sure about this, but we know that there's a genus of creatures called the diaperi. They're little crustaceans. They're tiny. They're big ones are maybe about a quarter inch or so across. And they live in the sediment at the bottom, especially in nearshore areas. And in healthy conditions that you see, that you used to see throughout the lakes and that you can still see in areas in Lake Superior, you find many thousands of these little creatures per square meter, on the order of 10,000 to 12,000 per square meter. I think the highest reported ever was 12,200 per square meter. Mm-hmm. Many places in Lake Michigan now, you see a dozen or so per square meter, and oftentimes zero per square meter. Their disappearance has been dramatic, and it's associated with the introduction of zebra mussels and quagga mussels, two invasive species. We don't know how, or we don't know the mechanism yet by which, and we're not even sure that it's the zebra mussels that are causing this, but we do know that when zebra mussels show up, soon after that, these creatures disappear. These creatures are tremendously important because they serve as one of the fundamental feeding areas for many juvenile fish. So if you remove the feeding source for juvenile fish, you disrupt the ecosystem in a profound way, all the way up to the largest fish. And I think that's one of the reasons, that's yet another reason that we say we need to take dramatic action, because so many areas in Lake Michigan are without these creatures right now that are very supportive. Another issue is the threat of Asian carp. There's two species of Asian carp that are in the Illinois River that are approaching Lake Michigan. That's another thing we can talk about if you'd like. They are voracious feeders of zooplankton, and zooplankton are another component of very low level on the food web that support almost all juvenile fish eat zooplankton. And when you introduce these incredibly competitive large carp into the system, they go through zooplankton so quickly that they deprive other fish who don't compete as well of the capacity to actually get enough food to grow to adulthood and reproduce. Mm-hmm. So you're right. There are really dramatic decreases in some of the fish, that especially the larger fish, and that may be associated. We think that's associated with some of these stressors or threats to the Great Lakes. Now let me just take a minute to talk about eating the fish. Many people still fish for subsistence, and many people enjoy fish. And quite frankly, we've read recently that it's important to eat fish, because fish are, you get omega-3s from eating fish, and they're a very healthy source of protein that's low in fat. So there's a suggestion that, gosh, you know, we should eat a lot of fish on the one hand. On the other hand, each of the five Great Lakes is under fish advisory right now. And the fish advisory say, depending on your age and your and if you're a woman, whether or not you're of childbearing age or not, or expect to have children, you should really limit your consumption of fish. You can go to the Illinois-Indiana website, point your browser to Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant, and follow the links to look at our fish advisories. We keep up-to-date fish advisories there. Just as a general rule of thumb, I'd say if you were a woman who was thinking about having a child, or you were pregnant, or you were nursing, I would avoid fish from the Great Lakes at this point, and the rest of us probably eat no more than one fish per month. And let me just say three things about if you do decide to eat fish from the lakes, which, as I've said, is an important source of nutrients for a lot of people. If you do eat fish from the Great Lakes, make sure that you take the skin off, the head off, and the organs out, and do not discard those. Do not eat those elements. Cook the fish on a raised pan, such that bake it or broil it such that the fat can drip down below, and then discard that. Do not save that for soups or frying other things in. That will keep some of the most harmful chemicals from getting into your system. I should also say you should trim the fat off, because the fat is where the PCBs accumulate. Now, mercury is another dangerous element that gets into fish and has been showing up increasing concentrations in fish from the Great Lakes. Mercury binds with muscle tissue, and if you're going to eat the fish, you're going to get the mercury.
Okay, so for that reason, then the best thing you can do to deal with that is just limit your intake.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is William Sullivan. He is associate professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. He's also interim director of the Illinois Indiana Sea Grant, which we've talked about a couple of times. And there are a number of these programs in different states. They're federally funded, and the idea is that it's supposed to bring together people from a variety of concerns, people in industry, people at universities, people in government, all of them concerned about the health of the Great Lakes and water, I guess, sort of generally water quality, natural water quality in general, to all work together to make sure that the quality is as good as it can be.
Right.
We have some other folks here to talk with. Let's do that. Next, we have someone back here in Urbana. Line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
For your guest, when is the last time you didn't get a blank stare from either a Great Lakes area politician or Great Lakes area reporter when you used a word like zooplankton?
He's thinking about it. I don't know.
I'm giving David a blank stare.
He's giving me a blank stare. Well, I guess the point the caller is making is just that these kind of technical issues, they're difficult, or that people don't know what it is you're talking about, or need a little basic education.
This is kind of confirms my opinion of the general level of ignorance and basic ecological terms and principles among both politicians and the reporters that cover them, who think any mention of science is at the PhD level, when in fact it's at the high school level. Hmm. And I guess that's the point I wanted to make, and I think it's something you probably run into constantly. Well, I hope I'm wrong.
Well, thank you for your comment. I think that's a really important question, and I think it's I think what you're speaking to is a general problem in terms of the ecological literacy of Americans today. And I think there's two ways that we need to approach that. One is we need to raise the ecological literacy of all students, and all citizens, and we need to start with our students to do that. The second thing is that it's important that those of us who are scientists and are concerned and committed to making sure our science has an impact on public policy make a considerable effort to find ways to share our information that's accessible to normal humans, to people who don't have advanced degrees in ecological or sciences or engineering or physics. It's incumbent upon us to tell the story in a compelling fashion, to get the word out so that our science has an impact on our society.
Any personal comments on your encounters with either reporters or politicians in this very, very important field?
Well, my most recent encounter at WILL here has been
wonderful. they're on a special level. Say, if you're from the Chicago area, some of the talk radio up there, I don't need to mention the station, but if any contact with folks from, say, major broadcast commercial networks.
Well, I think there's a challenge today in scientists in dealing with the media, and that is that there seems to be a growing trend in making every story or finding a way to make a story by creating a controversy and pitting one point of view against another point of view, or pitting the scientific data against someone whose opinion is that it doesn't matter. And I think I think that can be challenging for us, and I think the thing that we need to do is continue to focus on the evidence and say, these are what our studies show, this is what the evidence is, and these are what our projections show. And I think those – and to suggest the difference between carefully collected evidence that's been scrutinized by other scientists and that have been replicated in their various areas. And the difference between that and a person who has an opinion about the fact that it doesn't really work that way for him or her or in their community.
Are you familiar with the what I would call a debacle on the 2020 show with John Stossel regarding the huge issue of global warming?
No, I can't tell you the last time I watched 2020.
Well, I didn't watch it either, but on NPR's Media Matters, they confronted him because for the opposing view of global warming, John Stossel consulted science fiction writer Michael Crichton rather than a scientist, and said, well, we have to do that to get ratings. And Michael Crichton said, oh, that global warming is nothing but a big hoax.
Yeah. Well,
that's part of your communication problem, and when confronted with this, Stossel haughtily stated, "Well, we have to do this because we live in the world of broadcasting, and we have to get ratings. Never mind the fact that Crichton was unqualified to comment."
I think that I just go back to my previous comment and say that it's really important for us to rely on the evidence and talk about how we collected our data and how it's been scrutinized by other scientists, refer to it as evidence, and then contrast the evidence with points of view.
Good luck with that.
Right. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, I think that really, not to take too much time with this, but I think that you, the caller, and you both point to what is a really significant problem with a lot of reporting on science. And it has to do with the fact that reporters are taught to do this thing where you're supposed to balance opposing views. So if you have one person or maybe a couple of people who tell you one thing, then what you're supposed to do is go out and find somebody who'll tell you the opposite. And if you do that, this business of just strictly balancing the quotes, then one of the things that will happen is that people might get the idea that 50% of the scientists think one thing and 50% of the scientists think the other thing. Which makes it a standoff, when in fact there may indeed be a consensus among scientists that most of them are on one side, and you may find some on the other side who say, well, I'm not so sure. But I think that reporters are really uncomfortable with doing something that makes it look like they're taking a position. They may not really understand where the scientific community as a community stands on a particular issue, so they're not really sure whether there is consensus or not. And on top of that, if you have people who are reporting on scientific issues who don't have much background in science, who have a hard time, and I will cop to that too, who don't always understand the basic issues, then it gets really very difficult. And there is good science reporting, that's for sure. But in all kinds of mainstream media, I'm thinking, you know, the scientific reporting isn't always very good. That's where you get into problems like that.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons I think it's incumbent upon us as scientists to make sure our findings are accessible. It's no longer enough for us to publish in the elite scientific journals, and we need to find ways to make our findings accessible to the general public, to policymakers, to put it in a form that's memorable and understandable, so that ultimately we can base our public policies on the evidence.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true too. Not that I want to make it sound like I'm blaming scientists at all, but I think it's just, as you say, it's important for within the community of scientists to find people who are good communicators, who can put across the ideas and the concepts to people who are not scientists, so that they will say, "Oh yeah, okay, I get that."
Right. I think one of my favorite examples is Evan DeLucia, who's a faculty member on our campus, who's done a really wonderful job of writing editorial letters to newspapers and getting those letters published as opinion pieces. That helps us understand his science in a way that has an impact in our day-to-day lives and ultimately in public policy.
All right. Well, we have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them in and go next to someone in Chicago. Line number 4. Hello.
That's me. Mm-hmm. Here's a point of interest. The Shedd Aquarium did a program the other night, and they have on exhibit, I believe, some of these nuisance fish on display. It would be, might be of interest to some people to see that, like the Asian carp and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's true. In fact, I think just in today's Chicago Tribune, I saw a little piece about that exhibit. So if people are interested, they can seek out the paper, or I'm sure that the aquarium has a website that they can go to. Yes, indeed, you're absolutely right. So that might indeed make it more real to people if they can see the thing that we're talking about.
Yeah, they spend more time on flying saucers and Martians landing on the radio than they do about water, which everybody uses.
All right.
And in fact, I think Robin Gettle from Illinois India Sea Grant is up at the Shedd today with an educational program on these issues.
Well, okay, very good. Let's go to Champaign County, another caller here, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted, how does the Calumet Sagway and turning the river around, Chicago River draining into Illinois instead of the way it was, how do you feel about that? I know an environmental group made a press release about trying to redress that. I'm sure, I don't know how Mayor Daley would feel about that one, but I know there are a lot of factors. One of them is the invasive species business that was just referred to, I guess, because it's a route where we're mixing that's from two different watersheds, et cetera. So I'll just hang up and listen since there's a little time. Thank you.
Okay.
That's a very important question. I'm not sure that that's going to happen because you say it is tremendously complicated, and the question about invasive species is a really important one, and we're working to keep the Asian carp out of the Great Lakes, and they're right there knocking on the door right now. We've installed Illinois Indiana Sea Grant played a very important role in this, but the state of Illinois has installed a couple of electronic barriers in the Chicago Waterworks to in an effort to keep the carp from coming or getting into the lakes. And if you reverse the flow of the water, you could still have the electric barrier there, but I'm not sure it's a good thing to do at this point in time. Yeah. Although, you know, I must admit I don't know as much about that as other people, and if there was more time, other people would call in and inform us of that. I can't really speak to it.
The zebra mussel, if I'm remembering right, the way that it got here was that it rode in ships in the ballast where they pump water into the ship, and then at some later point along their journey, they flush it out, and that these things got into the tanks in the ship. They come into the Great Lakes, the ships flush them out, and suddenly here are these things that were never there before that came from someplace else. I guess the way to address that is to tell the ships that they can't do that. Is that avenue one, that avenue for introduced species, one that we have now closed off, or is that kind of thing still a problem?
Well, the policy says that we've closed off. The practice is that it's not quite yet closed off. Many of these ships don't completely empty their ballast water, and then sometimes the organisms in that small amount of ballast water actually does get deposited into the Great Lakes. It's surprising to know that we have about 170 recognized introduced species into the Great Lakes right now, both animals and plants. And we're gaining a new species once every 8 months on average.
Wow.
So it's not, with the global trade that we've got going on and the movement of organisms across all kinds of political boundaries, that's happening at a rate that's fairly considerable. It's not only ballast water, but species get introduced in the Great Lakes from the bottom of boats that have been in the Mississippi River and then moved to the Great Lakes or other areas. Also, there's been a number of cases in which people have dumped their bait into the Great Lakes, and the bait has survived and reproduced, and then that's become an invasive species. People get exotic fish in fish tanks, and after a while they decide they don't want those fish. They sometimes flush them down the toilet, or they dump them into a pond or a stream that empties into the Great Lakes, and then that's been a vehicle for introducing species as well. And then increasingly there's plants are being introduced from nurseries that sell plants for water gardens, and then people have these plants in their water gardens, and then they get released somehow into streams, and that's been a very important source of introduced species into the Great Lakes. So the ballast water is an important issue. That's been reduced somewhat, but there are a whole host of other issues that we need to keep our attention on. Yeah. And these are not trivial issues. Across the United States, we estimate we spend $100 million per year controlling zebra mussels, or essentially removing zebra mussels from the clogged intake valves that they attach themselves to. $100 million a year.
We're coming down to the point here where we're going to have to stop. And it, obviously, as people should understand by now, this is a very complex issue. There are a lot of individual issues that have to be addressed individually, and then of course they all contribute to this big problem. How do we have some closure at least here for this conversation? What do you want to say to people to finish up?
Thank you, David. That's a really important question. I'm glad to have an opportunity to address that. I think there's four things that need to happen. The first thing is that we need to restore the ecosystems. Self-regulating mechanisms along the shorelines, the water that flows in, the wetlands, that needs to happen. The second thing that we need to do is we need to remove these multiple areas of stress that are changing the ecosystem and its capacity to self-regulate. The pollutants that we've talked about, the water withdrawals, the invasive species, and other elements that create these stresses. The next thing that we need to do is once we've done that, or in addition to that, any portion of the ecosystem that's functioning in a healthy fashion, we need to work hard to protect it. Mm-hmm. And the final thing that we need to do is we need to set up a series of indicators, and we need to put measuring devices in the tributaries and along the wetlands and in the deep water column to make sure that we can monitor the health of the system so that when there is something that gets out of kilter, we can know about it immediately and then take aggressive action.
Right. Well, we're going to have to stop. We'll see if we can keep an eye on the issue and perhaps talk again. For right now, I want to say thanks to our guest, Bill Sullivan. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at U of I, also Interim Director of Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. Thanks.
David, it's a pleasure.